Internet Talk Radio. The medium is the message.
From San Francisco, welcome to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, with your interview host, Dr. Moira Gunn. On February 22, 1993, President Clinton and Vice President Gore introduced what is commonly referred to as the Technology Initiative. Its official title is Technology for America's Economic Growth, a new direction to build economic strength. This 36-page document outlines a plan with three goals. First, long-term economic growth that creates jobs and protects the environment. Second, a government that is more productive and more responsive to the needs of its citizens. And third, world leadership in basic science, mathematics, and engineering. Included in this initiative is the creation of information superhighways. These superhighways will introduce an efficient, high-speed communication system linking all areas of the public and private sector. The Technology Initiative was introduced by the President and Vice President in Silicon Valley over several days of well-publicized press conferences and meetings involving high technology workers as well as the presidents and CEOs of successful Silicon Valley firms. Until recently, there has been little dissent vis-a-vis the Technology Initiative. On March 25th, T.J. Rogers, President and CEO of Cypress Semiconductor Corporation, a Silicon Valley high technology firm, testified before Congress and presented written statements from 10 other CEOs and Silicon Valley businessmen expressing grave concern about the Technology Initiative. Dr. Rogers' testimony appeared in editorial form in the Wall Street Journal on Monday, April 12. Moira was able to speak with Dr. Rogers in his office at Cypress Semiconductor.
Now, before I ask you about your testimony, I think it's important for people to know a little more about you. Can you tell us about how you started Cypress Semiconductor and what it has become today?
Well, I am one of the entrepreneurs you used to hear about. Today I'm in excess of the 80s, but I used to be an entrepreneur. I came across the Sierra Nevada with everything I owned in a very small U-Haul trailer after graduating from college in 1970. Went to Stanford, found out about Silicon Valley after I got here, decided that starting a company was the most noble endeavor of mankind, did just that a decade ago in 1983, almost to the day. And we, the 1,250 employees of Cypress, have built up the company now to about a $300 million size.
The experience of Cypress has not been without its ups and downs.
Well, in the first 9 years since we started with a great technology, it was upward and to the right. And then in 1992, we ran into our first trouble, and in 1992, we lost money in 2 quarters out of 4, which is a traumatic experience for us. Since that time, we've made some changes in the company, made some changes in the way we run the business, and we've launched our second decade in 1993 with a good quarter. We're off to a good start, and we're feeling good about ourselves again.
All right, so you're quite familiar with Silicon Valley and the and how it operates here.
All the way from having worked in two Silicon Valley firms before starting the company, having gone through the venture capital process, the public offering process, listing on the New York Exchange, even to getting to be a decade old and having, you know, your first midlife crisis and then recovering from that and taking on. So I've pretty much been through the process.
Now, Cypress Semiconductor would benefit directly from the Technology Initiative, and yet you oppose it. Why?
Absolutely. We make supercomputer chips, which happened to be the topic of the particular committee meeting I was at. We make supercomputer chips for two different types of supercomputers, the Cray-type machine, the big number cruncher, and the so-called massively parallel computer, which uses thousands of less capable processors all running together. We also make chips for the electronic data superhighway, as the Clinton administration calls it. And certainly, if these became the topics or the subjects of pork barrel programs, there would be millions of dollars that would flow directly into our company. But just as any middle American asks themselves, not do I want it, but can I afford it, and is it worth its price, we have to ask the same question in companies, and it's amazing many times average citizens will be more picky about making a $500 purchase than the federal government would be with $1 billion. So the price we have to pay for our pork is that the government will raise the corporate tax rate by 2%, and the government will raise the income tax for the highest paid Americans. Right now, that group, the top 5% of American earners, pays 46% of all income taxes, and that's going to be raised because apparently 5% paying half the load is, quote, taking a free ride, unquote, which I, of course, don't believe. Both of those forms of payment will be devastating to the high technology industry. In terms of higher corporate taxes, if the Clinton administration, for good purposes, takes $1 million from Cyprus, that $1 million will come directly out of R&D. And that will mean something in the order of 10 PhDs who will either become unemployed or who will never be employed to work on research and development, in hopes that those 10 people working directly on the electronic data superhighway here in my company will somehow, that money will somehow funnel through the Washington sausage grinder and come back to benefit us more than our direct research in that area. I certainly don't believe that. On the other side, talking about taking money away from rich people is always popular. It's easy to say we'll tax the rich people. But the fact is, if you look at where the money came from to start this company and where the money comes from to start companies in Silicon Valley, it comes from rich people. It comes from people who've made money. For example, me, I'm in excess of the 80s. I made approximately $8 million in paper in the stock of the company that I got when it had one employee, me, and that stock's now worth $8 million. And I can't even use a fraction of that money. So my money is in investments in 100 high-technology companies. I recently did an audit of the 100 companies in which I invest in Silicon Valley. Many I know directly. Many I help venture capitalists evaluate. Many are customers of ours. 19 of them work on supercomputers or the electronic data superhighway. So when the government takes money from rich people like me, it's going to come directly out of those investments. I drive a 4-year-old car. I don't have expensive tastes. And if the government puts the tap on me, it'll come out of my investments. So the hidden premise behind the Clinton administration program is that they can rob or tax money from corporate research and development from Silicon Valley companies and take money from investors out of private investments, send the money to Washington, churn it through a pork barrel program, and do more good for high technology than the people online in Silicon Valley could. And I think that premise is clearly preposterous. I mean, before they start talking about electronic data superhighways, my favorite analogy is the tobacco industry. We have, without making any value judgment, we have the Surgeon General spending millions of dollars telling us smoking is bad and causes cancer. And at the same time, we've got the Agriculture Department, another branch of the federal government, subsidizing the tobacco industry to the tune of millions of dollars. So if in 2 decades the government can't get it right, whether it wants to support or not support tobacco, how are they going to make decisions about complicated things like electronic data superhighways and wireless communication? They can't. So when they've cleaned up their act and gotten rid of the Mohair Reserve and other little things like that, then come back and tell us how we need more taxes and how they're going to help us straighten out high technology.
I think one point that you're making that people will often wonder about is that they're listening and they're saying, I thought we were talking about the technology initiative. It must be something about the technology initiative, but you keep talking about taxes. Well, wait a minute. How much does the technology initiative cost, and where's the money coming from?
It's, last time I checked, about $20 billion. I actually, when I gave testimony in Washington in late March, had the opportunity to go to what's called a markup session. This is a session where bills nominally have amendments added to them. In reality, is slicing of the pork. Who gets what? Who gets cut out? Who gets put in? Fairly disgusting process. And at that time, we were looking at $20 billion. And that's going to come out of Americans. And it's, by the way, it's not just coming out of rich Americans, the bad guys, and corporations that, quote, took a free ride, as Secretary of Labor Reich likes to say, is coming out of all Americans, because when I was there, they were talking about the real income level where the taxes start at $30,000 a year. So that millionaire's tax is now $30,000, and anybody who made a calculation in the back of the envelope could have figured it out, because there's not enough money in rich people. If they confiscated their money, took all of their money at 100% tax rate to pay for the kind of boondoggles the Clinton administration is proposing. So it boils down to my basic question, which every American asks themselves every time they want to buy anything: do I want it? Yes. Can I afford it? And is it worth what they want for it? So sure, we might want some technology pork barrel program, but will we get, to use a Pentagon phrase, the bang for the buck? And the answer is no way.
Now, from your perspective, what would the $20 billion fund of the technology initiative? What are they trying to do from your perspective?
It's a potpourri. The particular panel I was in front of, supercomputers and electronic data superhighway, was $2 billion for those worthy causes. Well, if you look at supercomputers, they were invented to make hydrogen bombs. The leading company in the world, Cray, was essentially kept alive by the federal government, directly or indirectly, for years to keep that critical industry in the United States. It turns out today the market is falling apart. Cray is not doing very well. It's not that big. The Japanese companies that copied Cray are all losing money on supercomputers, because there are different, cheaper ways to solve the problem. You now can buy a tenth of a Cray to sit on your desk for $20,000. And if you ask yourself, would I rather have 10 engineers, each of whom have their own personal tenth of a Cray, or a Cray with all of its heat and maintenance, the typical company like mine will buy 10 machines and spread them around. So we're supporting propping up an industry that whose time has passed, and it's time to let the invisible hand take care of them and shift the market somewhere else and free the good people. Everybody, one of the problems with propping up old industries is not only do you waste money in unproductive technologies when your competitors are working on productive technologies, you also maintain some of your most talented people in unproductive technologies. I mean, if you just transport it in time and think about it, I'd be willing to bet you could find the Vacuum Tube Act of 1953 where the vacuum tube industry was in deep trouble, and we needed to keep all those valuable technologists and PhDs working on vacuum tubes because the vacuum tube industry was under pressure. Well, sometimes it's okay for an industry to die when another industry that's more powerful takes over from it.
One example of your the supercomputer, the Cray supercomputer, is how people needed to have these really big machines to solve these really big problems. And we were recently talking with the Super Collider folks, very big government-funded project. And they were telling us how, well, they're not going to have a supercomputer. They've figured out a way to have 64 workstations and fiber optics, and they get the same thing for a lot less. And how about that? They figured it out. And now let's look at the other side of the Super Collider. This is really a science machine. It's to do science. And it's not just funded by the federal government. It happens to also be funded by the state of Texas, which is kind of fun. It's located there, so that's fair. But also Japan has some money. Europe has some money. People, scientists and universities and labs that will be using it will have some money. This is a project that will be unlike any in the world, that moves one full step forward what we can look at from a particle physics standpoint. We'll be able to look inside quarks, they hope, in there. So this was technology that didn't happen before, and the government is involved because there really isn't a way to make a lot of money with this, and it's for pure science. To produce the electronic or data superhighways described in the technology initiative, do we have to make a major leap forward in technology, and can it be done without government intervention?
First, a comment on the premise of your question. I'm not a fan of big science, and I think we waste a lot of money. Running within 2 miles of my home is the Stanford Linear Accelerator SLAC, a two-mile-long tube that burned billions of dollars and produced one Nobel Prize for the W particle, which was coincidentally discovered at almost exactly the same time in the Brookhaven Laboratory, which existed prior to making SLAC. So I'm not a big fan of big science. I think our science money would be a lot better spread around to many universities, to many projects, and we'd get a lot more back from it. But then to the question itself, like the super collider, this wonderful step forward, do we need the same thing in the electronic data superhighway? The answer is absolutely not. The electronic data superhighway would happen for free, zero taxpayer dollars, if the government just got the hell out of the way. Of course, Al Gore's father was responsible, or at least the author of the bill that created the superhighway system in the United States. So this is a wonderful image that we have. The fact is, the superhighway is an optical fiber carrying bits. And today we have at least three networks that I'm aware of, coast to coast, ocean to ocean, MCI, Sprint, and AT&T. So if you want to take a bit and put it into a pipe, a light pipe, and dribble it across the country, you can do it today, and three companies have invested their money, not the taxpayers' money, in getting it done. What the image of the electronic data superhighway is, and by the way, I invite anybody to write to Washington to get a brochure they created to justify the electronic data superhighway, to pick these three examples of the future and read it and ask yourself, do I really care if this happens or not? I mean, do I want the Library of Congress in my living room, or would I actually pay a fee to prevent the Library of Congress from being in my living room? It's an invasion of privacy as far as I'm concerned. But this, the wonderful concept is data flows into the pipe anywhere in the United States. It goes on the main trunk. It comes back out, and you have anything you want to see. In today's world, your voice becomes bits. Pictures become bits. Information becomes bits. So pictures, sound, anything is bits. So these pipes which carry bits can carry any sort of information. So you can have a multimedia voice visual station which computes and takes things in and out for you. That's the image. What's required to do that is really a digital equivalent of the telephone network operating at much higher frequency. A picture requires many, many more bits per second than does a voice. So you need optic fibers instead of wires. But bottom line, you need something like the telephone network. If I were an engineer from Mars, and our planet had just conquered Earth, and the commander told me, we need to wire up the United States for an electronic data superhighway, and it needs to be done within a few weeks, and you need to go down there and take whatever assets you can find and splice it together, get your job done, I could have it done in a very short period of time because all the hardware is already there. What you need is every house to be hooked up. 60% of American homes are hooked up on cable. And then you need the hookup into everybody's home to go onto a high-speed transcontinental link, which I've told you already exists at expensive private corporations, and you're done. And, of course, you need the switching apparatus to switch people on and off the superhighway. Fact is, if you look at what's wrong, is those high-speed links aren't hooked up to people's homes. And virtually all of it is because of government regulation. The cable industry for years has had the hookup, I said, but they're forced to be in the movie industry. They're not allowed, for example, to carry telephone conversations right now by law. So one way we could do it, the Martian engineer would simply hook up the parts. He would say, why don't they already have it? It's all there. They just didn't hook it up. No wonder we beat these people. Another way to hook it up would be to hook up fiber optic cable. The baby bells have $80 billion sitting around waiting to invest. They will not spend the money to hook up fiber optic from the main trunks into everybody's house, which would probably be the ideal solution, because they only can charge for bits at the rate of telephone calls, and they can't get in other businesses. So, for example, if they bring in a telephone call in the form of bits, they can charge you for a call. If they bring in a movie, they can only charge you at the rate at which it would have been a telephone call. They can't say, I just brought you a movie. It's worth $4.50, not a nickel.
That's by regulation.
By regulation. So therefore, the baby bells can't justify spending the amount of money that they would be willing to spend because they can't get in the businesses that they'd like to be in, hooking everybody up to this wonderful system. The third way to do it is to do it wireless, like cellular telephone type technology. And, of course, the reason we don't have more of that around is that the Congress is holding up 200 megahertz of bandwidth, which could be used for data communications. For example, there are radio stations right now going out of business. if the radio stations could start transmitting data instead of country and western songs, they might make money, but they can't do it because they're regulated out of that business. So every time you look at a roadblock, it's not a roadblock of tearing up sidewalks and laying an optic cable. It's the government in our way.
There's hardware out there, and it's for video and data and voice, and right now everything is all segregated.
Absolutely, and it's by law. You see, in the old days, you could say, well, that's a telephone wire, and you can, that's where voice goes, and then the government can regulate it and charge taxes on it, and everything's nice and orderly, and a bureaucracy that can take taxes away from it can form. Then you have the cable industry, and they can regulate that, and they can charge money, and they can pontificate about whether or not it's too expensive, like this latest bill where they cut back on cable rates by law because they said cable was, quote, a natural monopoly, unquote. So they like to segregate things so they can control them and siphon money off into the government coffers. And now all of a sudden, everything's a bit. You go online and you look at bits and you can't tell whether it's a picture, whether it's an image of a page of the congressional record, or whether it's some teenager talking to his or her girlfriend. You can't tell. And all of a sudden, all those worlds are collapsing, and the government, the slow beast that it is, can't possibly keep up with the change. So they're in a state of panic right now because they're losing their control and their taxation capability.
Well, it is true. It's just data, isn't it?
Just data. Everything.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans in Technology. I'm Dr. Moira Gunn, and my guest today is T.J. Rogers, President and CEO of Cypress Semiconductor. You stated that with this additional tax burden which is proposed, it would cost your company $1 million, which would directly remove 10 PhD researchers. And I've heard people say, well, 10 PhDs lose their job, big deal. And I always say, don't you know about the technology food chain? What happens when you lose 10 PhD researchers?
We currently have about 30 PhDs in the company working in process development and a few others scattered around in other divisions of the company. It's a huge impact on us. If you look at a company and look at the amount that's left for an R&D budget, a typical semiconductor company has 15% R&D budget. If you lose 2 percentage points of the 15, that's 1/7. So it's kind of like having a 14% layoff in R&D. It's a huge impact. And if the impact on every company in America, siphoning the strength of every company in the United States would produce something outstanding, then you might be able to bear it. But the fact is there's nothing of technical merit remotely worth the impact, the hurt that's going to be put on every American technology company.
And without R&D, the products cannot get into manufacturing and spawn the jobs, and the products can't spawn the revenues.
In our industry, we make parts for computers. And in our industry, computers become obsolete about every 18 months, meaning if you don't have a brand new computer that totally obsoletes, wipes out better performance, lower price, the one you had before, in 18 months, you're on your way out of business. So you can't think of our industry as sort of a cash cow that you just keep milking. You have to think of our industry as a requirement for a continuous flow of new and astounding products into the marketplace, and the minute that flow slows down, your company gets hurt.
The technology initiative cites that government support of commercial technology by the governments of Japan and West Germany is the reason for those countries' successes, and this is the reason for American government to do that as well. Is this a correct argument in your mind?
I saw a wonderful cartoon the other day with regard to the European Technology Initiative. It showed quarterback Clinton and his football team, and on the other side of the football was the European team. Two of them were in wheelchairs, two of them were on crutches, and one had thrown a football which had just smacked a fifth of them right between the eyes, and it bounced off his head. And Clinton was saying to his team, "We're in luck. I've stolen the other team's playbook." And the fact is, the European Technology Initiative has been an unmitigated disaster, and we keep saying the Europeans do it, therefore we must do it. Well, shouldn't we ask the question, the Europeans did it, and did it help anything? An example, our supposed shining star is called Semitech, a virtually useless organization which has burned $1 billion government dollars with very little return to the taxpayer. Their equivalent of that is an outfit called Jesse. Jesse decided to pump billions of dollars into the European semiconductor industry because it had a tiny market share relative to both America and Japan. And after years and billions of dollars, Jesse has been totally unsuccessful, and the European semiconductor industry is still as small as it ever was. I think they have 7% share of market. Americans sell more semiconductors in Europe than Europeans make for themselves. So Jesse has been totally unsuccessful after dumping billions of dollars. For example, Jesse said to Siemens, "We're going to rationalize this market. We can't stand this competitive, you know, all companies, redundant efforts." It's one of the big arguments you hear, redundant efforts. The government needs to organize everything. So they went in and said to Siemens, "You will be the dynamic RAM company." That's a very high-volume memory chip. They went in to Philips, said, "You will be the static RAM company." And they rationalized
and
the industry.
They couldn't, one couldn't make dynamic and the other couldn't make
Well, they
static.
All agreed. They all agreed.
See,
when you get that much pork from the government, you get that much money, and the government says, "Oh, by the way, we'd kind of like you to make dynamic RAMs and kind of lay off the other. Here's your check for $1 billion. What do you think?" And then you say, "Yes, sir," and you don't do that. Well, it turns out Siemens is out of the dynamic RAM business. Philips is out of the static RAM business. Both companies have lost $1 billion, and the European semiconductor industry is in disarray. The only company that's doing, that at least has a presence in the market, is SGS Thompson, and they just got another $450 million government subsidy from France and Italy. So once they ruined their own semiconductor industry with government subsidies, they then decided to protect it. First you ruin it, then you protect it. By protecting it, you make a tariff. So they put a 14% duty on all imported semiconductors. So, for example, Cyprus ships about one-fifth of its output to Europe, 20%, and we have to pay, or our customers really have to pay, a 14% duty going into Europe. Well, what does that mean? That means if you're a computer company in Europe, the parts you use to make your computer with cost 14% more. So how would you like to be in a nice socialized country like Sweden, for example, where your taxes are already outrageous, and then in addition you're trying to run a computer company and your parts cost 14% more than the Americans' parts or the Japanese parts cost them? So what happens, of course, is they destroyed their own computer industry. And company after company in Europe has had, computer companies had deep trouble. So for all the money they put in, they've injured their semiconductor industry, had to protect it, and now they've hurt their computer industry, and that's the, quote, benefit. And the Clinton administration keeps talking about the Europeans do it, why don't we follow? The answer is, why the hell would we want to follow that? Another country we keep hearing about is Japan, and we keep dredging up ancient history. In 1970s, 76 time frame, the Japanese decided to enter the semiconductor business. At that time, Americans held 52 or 3% of market share. The Japanese held about 35%. The program was called the VLSI Initiative, and it was led by MITI, the Government Industry of Trade. And over the next decade, from mid-70s to mid-80s, the Japanese took market share about 15 points from the Americans. We concluded that, and this has been told us over and over, the Japanese government was involved, the companies got together, they exchanged secrets, the government put in billions of dollars, and if we don't do that, then we're going to be in deep trouble, and they're going to take even more. Protectionists like Clyde Prestowitz said that the American semiconductor industry was lost. Of course, he's wrong, since we've taken back market share from the Japanese the last 3 years in a row. The sky is falling scenario I just described was used to justify Semitech as being our equivalent government give money to the semiconductor
and
industry
program. And that is a consortium which is also funded by the government.
Correct. Semitech is the American Semiconductor Consortium, 50% of the money from the government, 50% of the money from the member companies.
And it would be continued to be supported and perhaps expanded under the technology initiative.
That's correct. It is a not only a big favorite of the technology initiative, it is the shining example that we must do more of. More on Semitech in a minute. If you look at the Japanese effort, the VLSI effort, and ask yourself, did they really do what we just said, give billions of dollars? The answer is no. It's outright fraud what's been reported about how the Japanese worked. There was very little transfer of money from MITI to the industry. The big companies never, ever exchanged technological information. Dr. Yoshio Nishi, was the head of the Toshiba Dynamic RAM program. Toshiba ended up being the winner among all Japanese companies in that market. So it was like the shining star of that VLSI program. Nishi ran it, and he's now since been ripped off by a little company called Hewlett-Packard, and he runs their integrated circuits effort at Hewlett-Packard. And Dr. Nishi testified in front of Congress 2 years ago when I said, you ought to go tell Congress the truth about the way the VLSI program worked, because we've been told the wrong thing for a long time, that he never ever at Toshiba would sit down with enemies from Hitachi or Fujitsu and explain anything to them technically, never change secrets, and that there was very little money that came from the government. What Dr. Nishi said the most important contribution of the VLSI program was to get a public commitment from the chief executives of the electronics companies that they would invest in R&D, dynamic RAMs, and continue to invest even if their profit and loss statements got worse in a future recession. So the public commitment to the program, he felt, was the most important part. And yet when it gets translated by the Semitech PR folks, it gets turned into their government throws big bucks at their semiconductor industry. If we don't, we're going to go out of business, which is absolutely incorrect.
In February, Bill Clinton and Al Gore visited Silicon Valley and introduced the technology initiative with great fanfare, which made it appear as if everyone was there in the Valley. But when you appeared before Congress, you brought with you statements from a substantial number of CEOs and other businessmen in Silicon Valley who expressed concern about the initiative, and the names of their companies speak for themselves: Sun Microsystems, National Semiconductor, Amdahl, Connor, Peripherals, and more. How did it happen that you came to know about their dissatisfaction and that they felt so strongly as to make written statements for the record?
The image in Silicon Valley is solidly behind the Clinton technology program is a masterstroke of politicking and a masterstroke of PR, and it has very little substance to it. For example, when Governor Clinton came through here, a Democratic friend of mine held a little fundraiser for him, and I was called up and asked if I wanted to come. Now, I wasn't told to come to a fundraiser. I was asked if I would like to, quote, talk to Governor Clinton, unquote. After all, he might become president, and you should give him your views. And under that invitation, I said, fine, I might come. Then I got a formal invitation that was printed and said, come and bring your check for $1,000 for Governor Clinton so you can talk to him. And I realized that, first of all, our company doesn't have a PAC, so any money would have been out of my back pocket. I had candidates I favored more. And I also realized that if I gave money to him, I would be construed as a supporter of his. So I chose not to go, and I was lobbied. My girlfriend was called and lobbied for me to go. I was pushed to go up there, and I said no, and forcefully. As a matter of fact, I wrote some indignant comment on the invitation.
I recall you wrote NFW. Why we can't say that on the radio. Just write to us, and if you can show you're over 21, we'll tell you what that means.
I wrote.
You were a little irritated, I think.
I wrote NFW on the invitation. It was I commented that in the Wall Street Journal, and a day later, from my mother, who's a school teacher in Wisconsin, I got a letter asking, you know, what does NFW mean? And I had to figure out how to get
around
that
one.
Yeah, I did. I was careful on that. So I didn't go, but take Gil Amelio of National Semiconductor. He went, and he thought he was going to talk to a candidate to give views. And from what Gil related to me, he wasn't too happy about the economic views of the candidate and didn't support him. But when the picture was taken, everybody in the room, including Gil, was counted as a supporter of President Clinton or Governor Clinton, which was not the fact. They were people at a cocktail party to listen to a candidate. As a matter of fact, 2 weeks later, Gil held a fundraiser for President Bush, which was his candidate. So there was a little bit of sleight of hand to give the solidarity image. And then coming back, of course, to have a dinner with 10 CEOs in a restaurant and have a lot of people take pictures, again, propagates that image. But when I called people up and I said, this spending is foolish, the taxes are devastating, I can't see how this could possibly be the right thing, I called up 11 Silicon Valley CEOs. 11 said, you're right, it's foolish, we disagree. And 10 of the 11 agreed to give me comments for my testimony. And again, talk about railroading. When I gave testimony in front of that committee, there were seven people speaking for the technology program and one against. That was me. And I called, I figured that they didn't have a balance and they would appreciate having a better balance. So I arranged for the chairman of a major computer corporation to come and talk along with me. And I called up and said, can you arrange that? And they said, you have 6 minutes. If you'd like to cut it in half so you can bring this other person, so be it. When I went there, the other seven people speaking for the initiative were basically employees of large government laboratories justifying their subsidies. I sat there with one person from a government laboratory, supercomputer laboratory, who actually told a story about the wonders of supercomputing, in which he felt he was on the frontier, a breakthrough of computing, and that they had used their machine for wonderful things. And this is testimony in front of the committee. They had designed, using a supercomputer, a better stress level in aluminum cans so that thinner aluminum cans would be more dent-proof than existing ones. And my rhetorical question is, why are we supporting this kind of effort? If we need better cans, why don't we let the can companies pay for them as opposed to supporting these computer centers?
Moira is speaking with T.J. Rogers, President and CEO of Cypress Semiconductor Corporation, about the Clinton administration's technology initiative and his perspective and opposing viewpoints. You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, with Dr. Moira Gunn.
T.J., can you tell us about what you call the politics of envy?
The politics of envy goes hand in hand with the other politics, which is tax and spend. And they're classic, and you see them all the time. In tax and spend, you get yourself elected by saying, we're going to have wonderful programs A, B, C, and D. In the old days, maybe there were military programs, new missiles, new airplanes for companies in Texas or California, or dams or roads. Today, they're high-tech programs, what I call high-tech pork. So you promise preferably 51% or more of the voters free things. We're going to spend money on you. You get. And then when the people who are going to get expensive things say, how will we pay, fearing that their taxes will be raised, you say, they will pay. So you get, they pay, tax and spend, they pay, you get. And they, of course, is better be a minority, less than 51%. So you never can talk about taxing the middle class. As a matter of fact, as the president did, you should talk about cutting the middle class taxes, as he did in a promise to get elected, which is quickly reversed. So who pays in this case? Well, the bad guys. The bad guys are those executives who prospered unevenly from the prosperity of the 80s. That's a rough quote from the State of the Union from the president, or the companies that took a, quote, free ride. That's a direct quote from Secretary of Labor Reich. So these invisible people, companies that have pigged out in the 80s, and these rich guys, Michael Milken types, they're going to pay. It's a wonderful way to get elected. Promise them everything, promise to tax the bad guys, and then get on with it. Several problems. I've already discussed when you tax companies, you're taxing that which creates wealth and jobs in America. You're taking away their research and development capability. You're weakening them relative to the Japanese competitors where it hurts most. And you're betting that the money you take from those companies' research and development will be more productive going through a Washington pork barrel program. Highly unlikely. And when you tax rich people, oftentimes you're not taxing the crooks they would like you to believe some rich people are, but people like me, I've worked hard, I'm proud of what I've done, and my money's invested in 100 companies here in Silicon Valley, and when they take some of my money, it will come out of those companies. Again, hopefully to be better invested through Washington. I don't believe that either. So the politics of envy is class warfare. You make corporations the bad guys, you make corporate executives the bad guys, and by the way, there are bad guys, corporate executives. There are some of us who've been in jail. There are some of us who spend too much money on themselves. There's some of us who hurt their companies. I think shareholders who own companies are waking up right now, and the excesses of those individuals, which are not pervasive in the industry, are starting to be attacked. And that's great, because for every one of those people who takes company money they don't deserve, it's a black mark on companies. And we can't afford that. We can't afford to hate that which generates wealth for all of us. It's self-destructive. And the worst part is we've got a president who plays upon the self-destructive nature of the system. That's got to come back on him. People have to understand that's bad.
When you spoke of government intervention in your testimony, you quoted John F. Kennedy. You said, "A rising tide lifts all boats." How do you envision an appropriate interaction between government and the private sector?
Well, given that the government can't sort out whether it likes or doesn't like tobacco, it's clear that it shouldn't be involved in the intricacies of any details. For example, I work here 16 hours a day, 5.5 days a week, and I can barely keep track of, and I have a PhD in my field, barely keep track of a $250 million company. Our industry is $50 billion, so it's 200 times bigger in silicon industry. And Silicon Valley is full of all other kinds of companies, equipment companies, disk drive companies, computer companies, and it's maybe 10 times more complicated yet. So if you can think of Silicon Valley as being thousands of times more complicated than a job which keeps me busy virtually all of my life, you can understand that the government doesn't have a chance of even knowing who the players are, let alone who the winners and losers are in any given week. And if they accidentally got the right script, it would be obsolete in 14 days anyway. So if the government wants to help, what the government has to do is create an environment. They need to be more like the weather as related to farmers, as opposed to someone who comes in and picks seeds and tells the farmer how to plow. They need to provide warmth and rain and let things grow the way they're going to grow. And that's why I used the Kennedy quote, "A rising tide lifts all boats." John Kennedy, today in today's world, would be an arch conservative Republican. He came in, complained about high tax rates, and the first thing he did with his economic advisor, Walter Heller from Minnesota, said, "We're cutting the tax rate," and precipitated an unprecedented growth in the American economy. He didn't come in and say, "I'm going to raise taxes and do all these wonderful programs." So if the government wants to help, then get rid of the regulation that's screwing up our ability for companies at zero cost to the taxpayer to make the electronic data superhighway. Get out of our way. I'll give you another example, FASB, the Federal Accounts Standards Board. These are the head bean counters for the United States. They just changed a rule, 109. Our tax rate, because of the way we account for things, just went up from 35 to 38%. That robbed money from research and development. These are the things which make, which cause the American government to be hostile toward the companies that produce our jobs and wealth. And they could be the other way around. They could support that infrastructure, like the Japanese do. If you want to really see what the Japanese do, there's government-industry cooperation. They work together to make the country and companies wealthy, and that wealth passes on to the Japanese. We need more of that. If, for example, the state of California would not tax 7% on capital equipment, we might decide to build more factories here. But right now, as compared to other states in the United States, if I buy $100 million worth of equipment to build a plant in California, I have to give Governor Wilson $7 million for the privilege of building it here as opposed to building it in Texas or Minnesota. That's why we have plants in Texas and Minnesota, and we're ramping down our plant in California. So rising tide lifts all boats. Get rid of restrictions. Make us competitive. And that's not saying not accountable. Everybody says, "Well, gee, those fat cats have got everything they need." I'm not saying that. If people aren't governing their corporations well, throw them out, fire them. Shareholders vote, get rid of the board of directors, start again. Accountability is great, but you don't get accountability by having a government nitpicking at you with millions of regulations.
You proposed a change to capital gains tax. Would you describe it and tell us how it would benefit the American economy?
Sure. First of all, you use the right word, change, as opposed to lowering. The country, Mr. and Mrs. Middle America, would be infinitely better off if the capital gains tax were lowered. The brick wall in Congress is that the capital gains tax is a, quote, tax break for the rich, unquote. Somebody needs to say, without being embarrassed, that Mr. and Mrs. Middle America would be richer and better off if the rich people who invested in companies and factories to create jobs got a better tax break than if they just put their money in government bonds. Somebody ought to say that. A tax break for the rich is going to be good for everybody. Teddy Kennedy's $400 million is sitting mostly in tax-free securities, doing nothing. If it were true that his advisors could make more profit on his assets by putting them in, for example, a stock of high-tech companies to build new factories and new jobs, then they do it. But the structure right now says, why take a risk? Why try to figure out Silicon Valley? It's too complicated. Put it in T-bills and forget it. Put it in tax-free and forget it, because you'll make just about as much money with no risk. So we need to make our country more competitive to lower the tax rate for people who risk their money investing in our infrastructure, jobs, and factories. Now, to get through the tax break for the rich brick wall, which I admit is there, I don't agree with it, but it doesn't matter. It's an effective brick wall. It's been hammered on for years, and it hasn't given an inch. I think we ought to restructure the capital gains during the first 6 months. If someone, say, buys and sells stock, churns it, let's double the capital gains rate. Let's take it up to 70% or 50% or 60%, some real high number. So for the traders, speculators, the Boeskys, the Milkins, the people who want to make a fast buck on Wall Street by churning stock, they pay big time. That will be soaking the rich. We can sell that to the American people. From the period of 6 months to 3 years, for people older stock, a half a year to 3 years, intermediate period, tax capital gains at the same rate as income. It's another way to make money. For people who hold their stock 3 years or more, let's eliminate the capital gains tax. Let's say if you put your money in America's infrastructure, we will give you a huge tax break. Maybe it's not zero, but some very low number, so that people start thinking about investing in a 3 or 5 year horizon, so that my investors, instead of saying to me, how you doing this quarter, will say to me, give me your strategic plan for how your company will be the most powerful semiconductor company 3.5 years from today. What's your plan? It'll force investors to think long term, it'll tax speculators, and it'll put money into America's infrastructure. That's what we need to do in capital gains.
So it's a true investment concept. You're looking to invest as opposed to reading the numbers game of what's going to change today and where are we this week and jumping up and down.
Absolutely.
That's it. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans in Technology. I'm Dr. Moira Gunn, and my guest today is T.J. Rogers, President and CEO of Cypress Semiconductor. What other things about the technology initiative do you find troubling?
I testified on supercomputers and the electronic data superhighway. On the way home, after going through the markup session I talked about, I had a copy of H.R. 820, which is the science and technology bill going through Congress. I mean, that's what's going to happen. That is the technology program. And I found out that the government, the feds, are going to go into the venture capital business. Now, of all the industries I can think of that we have that are healthy and doing a great job, that are the envy of the Europeans, certainly the envy of the Japanese, our venture capital industry has been one of the most successful financial institutions in the country. And apparently, Washington's record's not perfect. There's one group they haven't helped, meaning it's still doing well, that's venture capital, and they're going to go into the business. Secretary Brown is going to appoint an undersecretary. He's listed in the bill as the undersecretary with a capital U. Now, we know Brown, a political appointee lawyer, is going to appoint someone to be the venture capital undersecretary who's fully qualified and not political. And that person, in turn, will hire or appoint 7 more people to be the venture capital board. They will then evaluate applicant venture capital firms and determine whether or not they're qualified to be, quote, licensed, unquote, venture capitalists. That is, if they're working on, quote, appropriate, unquote, technologies. These are words right out of the bill. So the venture community is going backwards to 1984, and they're going to determine whether or not their thought processes are pure enough. And if they are pure enough, then they will become licensed venture capital firms. And, of course, then a ton of money will flow. For every dollar that a venture capital firm can raise from investors into its fund, the government will put in $2. So a venture capitalist who raises $30 million will be able to get $60 from the government and manage $90 million instead of $30 to invest in companies. The government will then oversee the venture capital industry, make sure the investments are appropriate. It will have the right to determine shareholder mixes of the venture capital organizations and basically start meddling in the nitty-gritty of the venture capital industry.
No, wait a minute. In terms of venture capital today, I mean, there is a whole structure of due diligence and regulation that makes sure that you don't sell, you know, the old super impregnated rabbits and all that. You know, it's like you're not selling your mother's house 50 different times. There already is a regulatory situation which analyzes whether your investment is okay and permits it to go forward, right?
Yes.
Okay. Now, in this case, we have a whole new layer or a separate layer.
It's more important than that. It's more invasive. Instead of just saying, here's a myriad of federal regulations for the venture capital industry, which they have an infinite number of now, and I've been through all of them myself, which literally costs a company millions of dollars in compliance during its lifetime just to keep up with the federal regulations. The new thing is the feds are going into the venture capital business. That is, they're going to take money, give it to venture capital firms, and have those venture capital firms reinvest the money in businesses. So there will become two classes of venture capital firms in the United States, the licensed venture capitalists and the, I don't know what you call them, rogue venture capitalists. The licensed venture capitalists will receive hundreds of millions of dollars in subsidies at the rate of $2 for every dollar they raise, and they will invest where the government agrees that they can invest. What will devastate the industry, we have an industry which is competitive. Venture firm A competes against B and C. Now all of a sudden there will be a class of venture firms which will be government subsidized. So it's just like you were in any business. You're in the chip business, and next door somebody builds a brand new plant and two-thirds of their money comes from the federal government, and you wonder if you can compete anymore. Suppose I'm a venture capitalist, and let's suppose my goal is to make 15% annual rate of return on the money which is invested in my fund. Then every deal that I consummate, I have to make sure it has a right return on investment. Now, if I'm a venture capitalist with two-thirds of my money coming from the federal government, then I only have to have a rate of return of one-third of that, because two-thirds of my money is free. The government will give me money, and they only want their capital back. They don't want any return on investment. So now, instead of having to make 15% on, say, $30 million, I have to make 5% on $90 million, and I get to keep all the profit, which is effectively 15% and $30 million. So these new schlock government venture firms will devastate the current stand-up firms who refuse to participate in the government subsidy. We literally have, if I could sit down and write, if I were trying to undermine the economy of the United States and somebody said, you know those venture guys, we got to do something about them, they do a great job, and I would write a document to undermine the venture capital industry in a politically acceptable way that looked okay from the outside, this is the document I would create. This is going through Congress. I just read this on the airplane coming home. Just couldn't believe it.
Now, the idea is to, I'm making this up here because this is the first I've heard about it as well. The idea is to infuse money into commercial enterprises. Is that the ostensible purpose of such a thing?
The ostensible purpose is for the government to put more money into, they have pre-competitive technology, you know the buzzwords,
yeah.
But there are certain technologies that are favored. So if venture firms agree to work to support, that is, start companies in favored technology areas, then the federal government will invest in venture firms.
Well, when I think about the government then choosing which technologies are appropriate, I go to a quote of yours saying, life in Silicon Valley is a daily sprint. Government moves at a crawl. When you put that against their decision making, I'm a little amazed.
Well, if you name the people in the history of Silicon Valley, just in my industry, started out with the first silicon company being Shockley, Clevite, one of the three men who invented the transistor, was a professor of mine at Stanford, and you have Noyce, Moore, and Grove, founders of Intel, and you had Charlie Spork and Jerry Sanders and a group of brilliant men who created the semiconductor industry. And we're now substituting their collective competitive wisdom for the judgment of some venture capital czar who will be appointed by Ron Brown. and they'll be making decisions is scary.
Cyprus has a record of on employee salaries and on stock options and stock ownership of employees. Tell us about that.
Our philosophy of compensation is, like the Japanese, the big guy should get no more than 20 times in Japan. Actually, here at Cyprus is about 15 times what the lowest worker gets, and that's what my salary is. And by the way, there are no hidden bonus programs. There are no special bonuses. There are no company cars. There's no company lodge. There's no free airplane flight or anything like that. My current compensation of $249,000 is what I take home. For a bonus program, we substitute profit sharing. Our theory of profit sharing is everybody earns profitly, equally, and because I sit in the corner office and somebody else works in a fab doesn't mean we don't work as hard. So for profit sharing, we take 10% of corporate profits and divide it equally among all employees. And that can amount to $1,000 a quarter during good times for our people. With regard to stock, every Cyprus employee is a shareholder and is given new stock every single year. We want people to think of the company as something they own and therefore treat like one of their own possessions, as opposed to some place where they work, where they try to get whatever they can.
One final question here. You were spontaneously applauded at the end of your congressional testimony, which is extremely unusual. Why do you think that happened?
Well, I went in and I held up a supercomputer wafer and I held up a chunk of the electronic data superhighway, and I commented that if these high-technology pork barrel programs came through, my company would take tremendous benefit. But I was there to tell them that neither I nor the men and women of Cyprus wanted any subsidies from the government. At that point, I was literally interrupted. I have to say it came mostly from the right hand of the room. There's a dividing line, Republicans on the right, Democrats on the left. And they were really happy to see someone who just said, leave me alone, we're competent, we can win. It's almost what you might call insult of welfare. I will give you welfare because you're not capable of coping by yourself. Well, the answer is most American companies are quite capable of coping by themselves, quite more competitive than the Japanese companies, and if the government would just leave them alone, they would win the game. But in their efforts to help, they cripple the high flyers, take away their money, take away their resources to try to put a safety net in for companies. And companies don't need safety nets. As a matter of fact, it's very healthy for some companies to say, yep, we're going out of business. The world doesn't need buggy whips anymore. And those 10 hardworking people in the back room, they would be better off working on in a new profession where they can contribute more to their company and to the country. So we shouldn't be protecting companies that are failing. We should either change their management because it's a management problem or let them fail so that the resources they're using could be put to better use.
Moira's guest has been T.J. Rogers, President and CEO of Cyprus Semiconductor Corporation. She spoke with him in his offices in San Jose, California on April 13th. An editorial outlining Dr. Rogers' position was published in the Monday, April 12, 1993 edition of the Wall Street Journal. Copies of the Technology Initiative may be obtained by calling the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy at area code 202-456-7116, or by writing the Office of Science and Technology Policy, the Executive Office of the President, Room 424, the Old Executive Office Building, Washington, D.C., 20500. This broadcast was brought to you in part by the Tech Museum of Innovation in San Jose, California. The Tech is dedicated to the spirit of innovation in Silicon Valley and throughout the world. Associate producer for Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is Monte Carlos. Recording engineers are Howard Gelman, Ed Herman, and Seal Muller. The music direction is by Sean Brain, with original music composition by San Francisco Songwriters. Distribution is handled by Larry Goldberg, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Your interview host is Dr. Moira Gunn. If you'd like a cassette tape or transcript of this broadcast, or to receive a complete program catalog, call 1-800-959-3430. That's 1-800-959-3430. send your written comments to TechNation, Americans and Technology, Post Office Box 590607, San Francisco, California 94159. This program was produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. For TechNation, this is Mike Amatori. TechNation, Americans and Technology, is a production of MogoTech Media.
This is Internet Talk Radio. You may copy these files and change the encoding format, but may not alter the content or resell the programs. You can send us mail to mail@radio.com.